My name is Lila, and I'm an alcoholic. Oh. I'll be perfectly honest with you. You know, I thought this was the year I wouldn't be doing it. It goes to show you. And I called Joe, and he said he wasn't sure what was going to happen. And a week or two ago, I don't know, I got the flyer when you got the flyer, and I thought, well, the worst thing that could happen is, you know, it won't be the intimate, close kind of thing that I'm used to every year for, as David said, for decades. So if I have to do it, you know, at the most it'll be 45 minutes or an hour or something. It's not a problem. And I was shocked to find the amount of time. I'm telling you this because I haven't been speaking a lot, you know, just because. And so let me start by telling you, David, how I love and respect you. And all the years that we've been doing this, and it's meant a lot to me. I'm used to the room, you know, when we left the church and we came over to the Drug and Alcohol Center. And I'm used to year after year, you know, seeing the same people pretty much over and over and over again. And I don't know, I feel rather emotional about it in a way, because I, you know, I look in my mind's eye, I'm thinking about the room and how intimate it has been for all of those years, and what it has meant for me. And I can see everybody, and again, you know, I kind of know where those of you that are here and those of you that are not here, I kind of know where you're sitting. And I guess the big thing about it for me, and why I looked forward to doing it absolutely every year, no matter what, Jane and I went out of our way to be there, was not so much what I said at all, you know. It was more the touch, the connection, to see the people that kept coming back, as you know, David, year after year, and how we changed and how we aged and how our lives changed. And God, I can, you know, Roy would sit on the left of me, and there would be Dina and Ginger on the right, and you know, and all the other people that went out of their way. I don't know why they would be going out of their way to hear what I would have to say, but I've never wanted to be anything but just, you know, I remember once talking to Jewel about how I didn't want to speak in AA, and he said to me, well, look, you know, you have a gift and you're going to have to accept it, and just pretend you're the coffee maker and you make a good cup of coffee, and that's always held me in good stead. The other thing he told me was, and I've never forgotten it, it was brand new, you know, when Jules asked me to go to the Salvation Army with him. And anyway, I was delighted, you know, to drive him down there. It was a big deal. He was sober longer than God at the time, and knew Bill Wilson and all of those kind of things, you know. And so I drove him down to the Salvation Army, and there was like five guys or seven, maybe five of them, I think. And we were in this room with the big refrigerator behind us with making all this noise. And I thought, well, you know, at least I'm going to hear, you know, this is really amazing, because this is like downtown LA, it's Skid Row, it's going to be great. And I'm going to hear Jules talk, and it's going to be wonderful. And he said to me, by the way, you know, you're sharing tonight. Well, I still wasn't quite over the stutter stage, because when I joined Alcoholics Anonymous, not that you'd know it now, but when I joined Alcoholics Anonymous, I was absolutely terrified. You know, being sober was not exactly comfortable physically in any way for me. And I stuttered, you know, and I didn't have anything to say. I was completely, as the nature of who I am, is a very, you wouldn't believe it, but a very shy person. And so I said, I can't be doing such a thing, you know, forget it, you know. And anyway, it didn't matter. Because you know how those old guys were at that time when you got sober. I got sober in 1969. This was probably 19, 670. And, you know, they didn't listen to anything you had to say, really. They basically just said, look, you know, go on up there now and tell your story. And there were the guys, five or seven of them. And, well, some of them fell asleep and, you know, they weren't even present. And I said to him, what am I going to do? I'm terrified. I mean, I'm absolutely, you know, I don't think I'll physically survive it. And he said, Lila, your job will always be when you speak in an AA meeting, whether there is one person or 500, you have to talk to one person in that room. One person needs to hear what you have to say. One person needs to hear what you have to say. And you may never know who that person is. So you give freely of whatever it is that's inside of you. And that is what I do. And that is the only way sometimes when I have no strength and when I feel like I have nothing to say and when the year has just exhausted me, when I'm restoring myself, when I've been reflective, when I think there's nothing there at all, then I know that there'll be one person out there that I will say something that will mean something to them. And that has been the journey of my life in sobriety, as David knows. This is what it has been like for me in the 51 plus years that I have been sober. I have gone from hearing something to hearing something to hearing something to hearing something. And I never know from where I'm going to hear it. And believe me, a lot of the time it is not from people with a lot of time. Sometimes out of the mouth of babes it has happened for me. But I'm a little off track anyway. So here I am. Jane and I are living currently in Ireland. We intended in the last 7 years, we've changed our life completely. This is what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, you make all these plans and then you hope to God that they work out. But, you know, it is what it is. And yes, I appreciate it. And I'm going to be all over the place because that's how I am. That's how I am tonight. I don't have a clue. You know, after all this period of time, you know, normally when you do a 95, an hour and a 45 minutes, it's structured. It's about the steps. You know, you get into it. You share all the stuff that you've known. I don't have any of that. This is not what I intended it for it to be. So it'll be whatever comes into my mind at any given moment. And that's me. And that's who I am. And that's who I will always be. And that's who I intend to be for the rest of my sobriety because it's taken me 51 years to be myself. So who I am is who I am. This is it. I am the most kind, generous, honest person I know. And I'm capable of saying that with you and about myself. And I'm attracting around me people that I can trust, that are consistently honest and consistently kind, because I just don't have the strength for the rest of it. You know, and that's what's come down in my life. I mean, you were all sitting there as I talked, I'm not finished talking last year, but really in the January of 2019, when I had lost my confidant, my friend, my best friend in Alcoholics Anonymous after 48 years of talking, oh, like every week, every other week, you know, when you lose your secret keeper, your confidant, the person that you can do nothing with. Is there more people more precious in this life than people that you do nothing with, that you can do absolutely nothing with, that you share nothing? I think back at, you know, there's a person, I remember Eileen, I don't know if Eileen is here, but, you know, I know that in the silence of Eileen is where we communicate, in the nothingness that we share together, in the silence, in the hug. I can only explain that because when Eileen came back into my life a few years ago, I knew her. I knew she knew me. And anyway, I had lost Gretchen and I was distraught over it, you know. And Mandy's here who shared in helping me with that death. And then last year, it was like our lives just sort of moved on. And we knew that we'd be spending more time in Ireland. And Jane was here most of the time. I don't even know if she was with me last year when I spoke because she might have been here. I'm not sure. But she's getting her citizenship in Ireland. Jane has three great grandparents from Ireland and great heritage here and ancestry and everything. So she's getting her Irish citizenship as well as her American, obviously. And I have an Irish citizenship because I was born here in Ireland. And I used to always say, you know, over the years, I'm going home to visit, you know, Ireland. I'm going home, I'm going home, I'm going, where are you going? Oh, Jane and I are going home, and I'm going home, and I'm going home. Do you know what happened to me this year? I'm home. I'm not going home, I'm home. It has absolutely shifted everything I know about myself. I'm back in my country. I'm back with the people that are my people. I love the sounds. I love the sounds of the Irish. I love the culture. I love the laughter. I love the quiet. I love being home. I never thought I'd be back. I never thought I'd have the privilege of being back. So now I'll be visiting Santa Monica, California. We are very fortunate that we have a home here and we have a home there. And I'll be visiting the United States of America. But I will be coming from home. We live in Killarney. We actually live in Muckross, which is down the road from Killarney. And it's as if we got dropped into a little, there's a song in Ireland, you know, it's a little piece of heaven dropped from out the sky one day and it landed in the ocean in a place not far away. And I have the funny feeling it's the Kingdom of Kerry, as I live in County Kerry. My grandparents are from County Kerry and my mother's family is from Galway. I spent most of my time as a young girl in Ireland in Galway. And then my Kerry grandparents moved to Dublin. So when my mother would have a child, my mother was the Blessed Virgin reincarnate, my father was an alcoholic. And so there were lots of babies, you know, being born. And every time my mother would have a child, she would go down to her family to the farms in Galway and in Galway. And I would be then taken as the firstborn child and adored to Dublin and with my granny and my uncles. And in the 11 or so years that I spent in Ireland in my youth, I never spent any time outside of my granny in Dublin's bed because I would sleep with her when I went to Dublin. And then because there were so children and so many people visiting, the Dublin people loved to come down, the Kerry people, everybody would come to Galway to my Nana's farm. And so there was my Nana lived in the thatch cottage her whole life. And up the road was this, we used to call it the stone house. It was rather a large house and that's where everybody stayed. And as my mother would come and have her babies and all the visitors would come, I would be taken to my Nana's cottage and I would sleep with my Nana. So up until I was 11, I never slept in a bed that was not that of my granny or that of my Nana. And I was adored and I was loved and I just was a child without really friends. I would say a few cousins in the town and my brother and my sister and myself. Just before we left Ireland, my father became one of the first members of Alcoholics Anonymous in Ireland. There was a man named Aidan McSweeney that I now know had a camera shop, kept it open in the evening, and my father was one of the people that showed up there. My brother Aidan was named after Aidan McSweeney in Cork, Ireland, and my brother died at 21 as a direct result of our disease. My father remained a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and went to the welcome room. We moved to Canada, Toronto, Canada. In Toronto, my father was a member of the welcome group there, and it was a really nice time in Canada. It was different. My best friend was, believe it or not, an English woman named Elaine. We still communicate to this day every Christmas. Every Christmas, we get a Christmas card from each other, and it just does nothing more than assure us that we're still alive. She was my best friend, an English woman, can you imagine? Anyway, my father got tuberculosis, and the treatment at that time was to go to the provinces of Canada for the drier weather, whatever it was. You know. So we went out to Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. Oh, Jesus, Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. It's on the edge of the nowhere, and it was very different. But it was wonderful because my father started a welcome group there and we met Betty and Gordon and all these wonderful people that eventually, you see, my father was a very charismatic, expressive Irishman, and charming and bright and intelligent and all of these wonderful things and qualities. And people just adored him and they followed him around, and he was kind of like a bit of a guru. And so he came down to, eventually came to the United States. Some of these people came with him. This is all going to make sense in a while as to who I am, what the nature of who I am, the kind of alcoholic that I am. My father had a scar, obviously, from tuberculosis in his, on his lungs, and you're not allowed into the United States if you have any of that kind of thing. But my mother said, you know, my mother was a very interesting woman. My nana, her mother, used to read the tea for the gypsies, you know, that came by at the farm. And my mother had a gift, you know, she could see and she could hear. So she said to my father, go again, this time you'll be all right. And he went again for this test that clearly should have shown a scar on his lungs, but it didn't. And we were allowed to enter the United States of America. My mother had a child in Canada, and then my brother was born in 1961, Gerard Kennedy. You can tell the year, in the United States of America. My father changed when he came to the United States of America. We have been through very difficult times as immigrants throughout after leaving Ireland, and all of the security and the safety and the comfort and the peace and the contentment and the ease of it. And we had a tough time in Canada. My father was rich and my father was poor, and my father was up and my father was down, and my father was everything. And then my father decided that, you see, when you're smoking marijuana and trying LSD and doing all of these things, you can do that as a member of AA, because after all, you're just not drinking. And I can assure you, after my father being considered so stable in Canada and taking LSD as part of an experiment that was going on with AA members, by the way, at the time, when we got to the United States, my father ultimately saved the time, ended up leaving Alcoholics Anonymous. And these people that were, he had followed him down here, remained on Alcoholics Anonymous, and they became my family with my mother and my brothers and sisters, and they saved a seat for me. I would go to the meetings with them and drive Betty, because she couldn't drive, so I would drive her, and pour my little glass of scotch and into a coffee cup and drink it in the AA meetings. I thought the stories were great, and I didn't mind going at all. I was half schnockered by the time I got out of the place. And, you know, she was always terrified with me driving her back home. And then finally that had to stop, because, you know, we almost got killed a few times. You know, I would be stone drunk by the time I left the meeting, and she would be saving a seat for me. I never wanted, and I wanted to make sure. And by the way, before my father left Alcoholics Anonymous, he knew a lot of people that became very personalities in Alcoholics Anonymous that used to be around our pool when we lived in West Covina, California. And I knew these people, and I knew them because I was drinking all the time. And I was drinking at a very young age. And as my father got sicker and left Alcoholics Anonymous, I understood that I would never, anyway, then life went on. I drank, I did all the things that you do, and I ended up experiencing the first and second and third step, you know, what it was like. What was it like? I ended up on a bathroom floor. What happened? I had a spiritual experience that I now understand, and what it's like now is that I've been sober all of this time. I never wanted to be a personality, nor do I want to be one in Alcoholics Anonymous. I am afraid to be anything but right-sized in AA. I've gone out of my way to make sure that when I talk to someone in Alcoholics Anonymous, I see who you are, I feel who you are. That's who I am in AA. I will never be anything more than that. I have met extraordinary people in Alcoholics Anonymous who've taught me so, so much, you know. I was thinking today, you see, what's happened is that when Jane was here and we were waiting for her to get her citizenship, I'm off track, okay, she was not coming home as frequently, and I was back in Santa Monica wrapping up things, because we made a decision that we were going to, we sold everything. I wanted to stop work. I stopped working officially for anybody in the mid-90s. In fact, I had met You, David, as you know, in 1998, that restaurant downtown when I was working a long time ago. And by the mid 90s, everything started to change for me. This happens in life, you know. It all comes at once, have you noticed? I had been in a relationship that, you know, I never discussed really with people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't think it was any of their goddamn business. But a lot of people thought I had this amazing relationship. Well, I didn't really. It was a relationship of tremendous convenience, and it was easy for me. And I traveled a lot, and I was very, very busy because I put so many things in front of my God for so long. It's shocking that I even made it. I stopped working then, and I started to work for myself, and I just managed our own portfolio for all of those years. From then on, I never worked for anybody again. My business partners and I had a different vision, and it broke my spirit, sort of, you know. I didn't recognize that we had a different vision. And at the same time, it was clear that my relationship was not working and that I needed to change that and get out. And then Gretchen moved to Oregon. So all these important things happened at one time. And I just thought to myself, you know, it's just not enough. You know, I've been going to meetings. I was a regular attendee of meetings. I used to go out of my way now. I was blessed to be going to meetings in Los Angeles at the time when it was on fire, you know, when the young people's meetings had started and women's meetings were abundant and men's meetings and gay meetings and God meetings for everything. And everybody was talking about all sorts of things, and singleness of purpose was no longer as rigid, and the spirit of Alcoholics Anonymous had expanded itself. And I was so grateful to be in a city like Los Angeles where everybody was talking, where you could talk about the fact that you had taken drugs, because God, who in the world hasn't, except perhaps me, you know. I had a little hashish once and thought I saw coffins and everything. I thought, this is going to interfere with my alcoholism, and I just went back to drinking. Just a hardcore alcoholic. Those of you that know me know that I'm just one of those drinkers of, you know, bourbon and scotch and whiskey, and if there's nothing else, I'll drink anything that's white or, you know, anything else. But I've never ever and I shudder to think that I ever would have a drink with an umbrella or a cherry or an olive or some bullshit thing like that, and the toothpicks and things. I just, a waste of space, to be honest with you. I drank my alcohol just in a warm room temperature glass. I can still hold it. I've never spilled a drop in my life. I wasn't one of those falling off bar stools people. I just sort of wasn't. I could hold it. It was absolutely amazing. I thought I'd be able to drink forever. And then, you know, I started to fall off a bar stool. My, you know, clothes just sort of like disappeared off my body every now and then. And I couldn't get my car to where it was supposed to be. And where am I going with all of this? I'm going to the bathroom floor, and bam, I'm on the bathroom floor. I wake up because I hear myself looking in the mirror and saying, God, help me, God, help me. I'm in rage because I said, God, help me. So I'm the kind of alcoholic that believes that when you are drunk, when you are unconscious, when you're on the bathroom floor, when you're down there and you've given it up, when you have absolutely nothing left and you say, oh God, I believe that that is when the miracle happens for me. So I believe in the spirit of AA. I believe that I was blessed before I even got to you. And within a short period of time, I ended up in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Absolutely no decision to stay at all. I intended to stay for maybe 3 weeks exactly, and then I was going to be out. I sat there in pain. I sat there with, you know, my eyelashes hurt, my hair curled. I was sweating green. They didn't have all these rehabilitation places and everything that everybody seems to have these days. You just shook it out, you know. And when you walked into the room, the greeter, like they had these secret languages that they would speak, and then they would lead you over to the seizure row. I'm speeding this up, you know, walking over the seizure. And I was in the seizure row. I didn't even know I was in the seizure row. Oh my God, you know, I'm an erotic. That would have really flipped me out. But I was in the seizure row, and the guy beside me was moving, and I was moving, and nobody said, you're making noise, you have to leave the meeting. You know, they just like ignored you. And you sat there and you're like, oh my God, and dead people floated in the ceilings, and it was just unbelievable. And then I got moved back to the third row, and then I resented that I had to give up my seat in the seizure row. And then I got a commitment, and then they fired me from the commitment because it was a cookie commitment. And I got the best cookies you could possibly buy, and I arranged them, and I merchandise them, and I did everything that you do with them. And if somebody touched a cookie, I went enraged, and I was up all the time fixing the cookies, because anytime they took the cookie, and they fired me, and they gave me the ashtray commitment. And you can imagine, you know, 1969, I can tell you, everybody smoked. It was a lot of ashtrays and a lot. It was a mess. And then finally, I graduated to be the dishwasher. I really wasn't the dishwasher till Eli and I got the job at the same time. We would wash dishes for about a year and a half together, and we never, ever talked. It was a fantastic relationship. It was an amazing thing. He washed, I dried, somebody put away. He washed, I dried. So I'm one of those kitchen people. You know, I love to be in a meeting, and I'm always the guy that's going to help wash the dishes or do something like that. I learned from the beginning how to stay. I stayed because I was competing with you. I stayed because I was curious what was going to happen to you. I stayed because I wanted to know if that thing would work out with that guy. I stayed because they hauled us to these ice cream parties for birthdays for people in their apartments, and they sat you down. I stayed because I was too afraid to cross in front of the meeting and say, fuck all of you, I can't take one more meeting, I gotta go. No, because I couldn't cross in front of the room because I was too shy. So I ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous, fighting every step of the way, looking at the signs and thinking, what could they possibly mean by easy does it? What could that mean? But for the grace of God, go I. Well, I sat with people who were bleeding and whose teeth were all strange in their mouth. But for the grace of God, go I. And I thought, oh, my God, I can't stay. And yet I stayed. And yet I stayed. And yet I stayed. And then I stayed until I knew how sick I really was. And I knew then I had to stay. And I knew that I had found my place. And I'm telling you, I found it with people that were not like I thought they should be or I thought I was. I stayed. And now I am one of those people that can tell you without a question of doubt, because I'm going to tell you anyway, that if you do not regularly attend meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, you're putting yourself at risk. And there's a really good chance you're going to drink again. And if you don't drink again, I don't care. I only know this, that the people that don't go to meetings drink again. So I go to meetings. I have not gone to meetings. I don't know how not to go to a meeting. And one of the great things about going to meetings is that eventually you automatically just sort of go when you need to go. The other thing I never wanted to do was to talk to anybody, ask for help. Oh, my God. Tell anybody my secrets. I come from a country where you don't air your dirty secrets. You don't tell anybody anything, in fact. Well, I did. I had to talk. I had to call people. I had to, you know, had a dime, we called it in our pocket. I had to call people up and I had to ask somebody to be a sponsor. Can you imagine the humiliation? I had to ask. And then I had to like do what they told me to do. And you know what? I did it. I don't know how I did it, but I kind of know now that in that bathroom floor when I was praying for help, that something just sort of dulled out my mind. And I became cooperative, and I did that. I used to go out of my way to be able to arrange meetings when I traveled. In a very short period of time, I started to have the other disease of people like me. I was sober, and I was dying from the potential, practically. I was successful reasonably quickly, and I traveled a lot, I used to fly into New York early so that I could go to the Mustard Seed for the Sunday women's meeting at 3:00. I loved going to Parry Street. I loved that I could be in LA and I loved that I could be in New York. Why is that important now? Because I'm in a period of reflection and I'm looking back why I stayed, what I got. I don't see anything wrong. I'm like a person that, you know, when somebody dies, all you remember eventually is all the good things about them. It's as if everything that ever got in the way of me has died. It's just like everything I've ever done to worry myself, to judge myself, to be critical of myself, to be unkind to myself, to get my own way has gone. It's just gone. So I'm looking back and I'm remembering, oh my God, the magic of Los Angeles and the freedom of it. The wonder of Parry Street and the Mustard Seed. They're going to, you know, with Jules saying, I need you to bring books into Hong Kong. We've got to get them into Red China. Bring as many books as you can. Bring 2 suitcases. And then you've got to get these books into Taiwan. I said, Jesus, you can be arrested if you bring books at that time into Taiwan. It doesn't matter. He said, it'll be worth the risk. We've got to get the books. You know, I look back and I see my history. I'm having things revealed to me. Here we are in Ireland now. I didn't intend to stay here. This year, I'm one of those in for a few months back to California, but Jane had to stay because she's getting her citizenship. And guess what? I finally got out of Los Angeles on the last Aer Lingus flight because I'm so stubborn in March. direct to Dublin, or I wouldn't be here. And so here we are, and now COVID comes. It's like, wow. Wow, it came. And get, I have finished selling everything. We've done everything. We have nothing left. I have no obligations. Jane cried. She can't believe I was willing to, you know, give everything up and just be a person. And I am. I've given everything up. We just have a house here and a house there. And all the stuff. This is the last year that everything closed out. And I got to Ireland on the last flight before they shut the whole bloody place down. And here we are in Ireland. And now we're staying here because it's safe-er, and I won't be getting home for many, many months, probably toward the end of the year. And oh my God, we're here we are in the park, in the middle of the national park in Ireland, and I have had nothing to do but to think about all of these things. And my life has changed as a result of the quietness, as a result of the sounds of the accents at home, as a result of the people. There's been extraordinary experiences that I've sat back and I watched Jane, you know, there in rural Ireland here, they have meetings of women's meetings in, you know, you're going to think this is shocking. Those of you from Los Angeles and everywhere else other than Ireland, the women's meetings in Dublin, but they're not listed or anything, you know, because you know, they're just not. That's a whole other story. I watched Jane and another woman, Mary L. from Chicago, who's been here for many, many years. And the two of them got together and sure enough, they start a women's meeting. And I'm just sitting back thinking, oh my God, look at that, the wonder of it. And then the women come into this meeting and it's, you know, in person, it was pre-COVID. And I couldn't believe I was listening. It was as if there was a brand new thing blowing, and it was amazing. And it was coming out of my own home. And then all of a sudden I would be getting calls in Los Angeles from Jane saying, bring coins. We need, you know, we got to get birthdays going here. We're going to like whatever, because look at Los Angeles. Do you have any idea how extraordinary it is there? I mean, everything is celebrated in LA. Happy birthday, 50,000. My God, you know, here people don't even talk about how long they're sober. I mean, these events, well, I can tell you that's over now. And then COVID came and the Zoom thing happened. And there was this group of women that had formed, Jane and Mary L, had formed this little group of women. And they were like just a handful of them. I don't remember how many because I was in and out of the country. And Jane was here the whole time and this is all happening. And I would come back with bags of coins and all the things that they required to bring home from America to assist, you know, with whatever they were doing. And then COVID came. And this little, if you're in Killarney, the women's meetings are held in a Methodist church on Countess Avenue at the corner of Muckross Avenue. And so the Countess group was formed. And when COVID came, then they decided that they would put the little Countess group on Zoom. And before you know it, now the Countess group from Killarney, Ireland, women that had no meetings, no means of communicating with one another, has been the most extraordinary thing that's ever happened to me in my sobriety, next to getting sober and watching the explosion of AA change in the first 20 years of my sobriety. And then there was 10 years of like quiet, and now in the last 20 years, it's been exciting. And the last 3 years, it's been the most exciting time I've ever had in my sobriety, watching this all happen. And what's happened? What's happened? By the way, it's a closed group, so don't even like be chatting about how you're going to attend it or anything. They've decided to keep it small and intimate. But now there's people from Glasgow, Scotland in the Countess group. There's people from the United Kingdom. There's people from Paris. Unbelievable. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable to watch AA in front of your eyes change and grow and be all the time. To be alive, to be 73 years of age, to be in a country, to be married to someone that for the last 27 years has been the most consistent thing I've ever had in my life is the love that I have received from this woman. Consistent. From growing from an immigrant family from country to country where there's no consistency, with an alcoholic father, with a father, despite his years in Alcoholics Anonymous, who never spiritually healed, who never took advantage of AA, who never actually worked the steps, who absolutely based it only on the fellowship, on the personalities, on all of that. And oh my God, to trust that you were going to be safe in Alcoholics Anonymous just because of the fellowship is foolish. When it came time when those businesses changed and Gretchen left and my relationship was freely open, over, and I was so lonely. There's nothing like being in a relationship that's not there to make you really, I realize how lonely you are. I was so shook up because I thought, what am I going to do? And I got offers that were beyond my greatest imagination. And yet inside of me came that thing, no, no, no. And I thought, oh my God, what am I going to do now? Because I didn't think that Alcoholics Anonymous was enough anymore. I thought, where is there more? There has to be more. There has to be more. There has to be more. And thank God, some people came into my life and they talked about the steps and making them your own. And they, you know, a Betsy Ryan and all those kind of people showed me things and talked to me. They talked to me about the spiritual aspect. They said it's one thing to get sober and to be physically sober. And it's another thing to find out that you need emotional balance and to get that together. But oh my God, until all of that becomes within yourself, until you get spiritual, until you understand the gifts and the extra things in this program, it will never be enough for you, Lila. You're a child of Ireland. You're an Irish woman. You're a child of curiosity. I'm a person who chased leprechauns. I almost drowned in a river in Ireland chasing a leprechaun. And then, you know, I mean, you know, do they exist or not? But, you know, I almost lost my life changing. Do you think that I'm not curious? Do you think that when I come from a house where my mother would say, let them in, that I'm not the kind of person that's going to want more? And I needed so much more. And I didn't see it because I wasn't reading the book like someone that needed more. I was reading the book as someone that was an alcoholic who needed to stay sober, a drunk. But oh no, I don't read that book anymore like that. I read the book as someone that wants to live a life on life's terms. That tells me how to do it. It tells me what to do and what not to do. And then I found the great blessing, the extension of the big book in the 12 and 12. It made perfectly good sense to me why they would have written that book after the 12 and 12 years later. Because my God, all these people that were sober, were staying sober. They needed more. And so we have the steps expounded upon. I mean, in the book, the big book, six and seven, a couple of paragraphs. To me, they're the most important steps. They're like a seesaw, and they're the balance. Oh my God, you know, every day when I need to restore myself, and it's been going on now for the last few months, when I knew that everything I ever believed in had to change one more time, when I knew that I had to give up my expectations of you, all my expectations, that I was dying from what I expected and how I expected you to be. I still had expectations. That I had to give up wanting people to be what I thought they should be and what they needed to be. That I had to give up fixing the world so that I would be comfortable. That if I didn't find a place within myself, you know, Dr. Bob had that thing on his desk that he had. It says, well, I'm tiny writing in the dark, but he explains what humility is. It's a perpetual quietness of heart. It is to have no trouble. It is to never be fretted or vexed, irritable or sore. It is to wonder at nothing that is done to me, to feel nothing done against me. It is to be at rest when nobody praises me. And when I am blamed or despised, it is to have a blessed home in myself where I can go in and shut the door and pray to my God in secret and be at peace as in a deep sea of calmness when all around me is seemingly trouble. And that is what I have found this year. From 50 to 51 has been the most important year of my entire sobriety. It is built upon the foundation of the Los Angeles meetings, the Perry Street, the mustard seeds, the stealing the books in and out of various countries, the looking for meetings and places, the going to the Catholic Church and saying, do you have AA meetings in this town? The play coming back to Ireland, and as Jane and I would come over the years, home to visit and saying, oh, where in the world are we going to find a meeting? There are no directories, you know. And this is in the years gone by. And I said, oh, this is not a problem. We'll just run into that pub because they're going to know where there's an AA meeting. And that's exactly what would happen. And we would go into the pubs and we said, you know, and they would look at you like, Jesus, you're, but Americans just let it go, you know. And yes, we found them. And we found, I look back and I think on the backs and on the prayers and on the wishes and on the words of so many people and so many meetings, I see absolutely, I am so proud of my time in Alcoholics Anonymous. I can't tell you. I can't tell you. Now, you know that I've been home in Ireland. I found a word not too long ago, an Irish word. Iarmhéireach. You know, and in Ireland, the language, you know, it's an important language because it was a language that we were not allowed to speak for a very long time. But this is a word, and it means an entire paragraph. An entire paragraph. And the word means the loneliness one feels as the cock crows when you are awake and feel your own aloneness. And I heard that, and I knew that I understood and accepted something I have never understood and accepted before. That in the middle of the night, I feel the loneliness. But let me tell you what that loneliness is. And I accept it now. It's the missing. It's the missing of all the people. It's the missing of the dreams. It's the missing of Ireland. It's the missing of the nanas and the grannies. It's the missing. I'm not lonely, but I have had to reconcile this year with the missing. With the missing of my brother and the death and the missing of my sister and the missing of the mothers and the missing. And I have done so. And when I feel alone in the aloneness of who I am not uncomfortable. Because for the first time in my life, I am within myself. I have finally been practicing these steps. I remember in the 90s, you know, I needed that more. And I thought, I'm going to have to find more. And I did. And I was alive with this, you know, and I couldn't believe there was so much information in those steps. And I was like on fire. I was on fire. And people helped, you know, helped me. And we talked about it. And we talked about the steps. And Gretchen and I formed this little group, you know, to talk about the steps. And hell, they didn't give a damn. But we ended up talking about them. And then one thing led to the other. And a friend of mine, Charles, said, would you come to Tulsa, Oklahoma, and, you know, talk to a few of us now about the steps? You're on fire with these steps and how you perceive them and what have you. And Charles, God rest his soul, Charles used to say, if there is good, there is better. How many times have I thought that when things were tough? If there's good, there's better. And I went to Tulsa, Oklahoma, and I thought it would be just a handful of people sitting around, you know, as I invite you into our room, this living room this morning, this evening here in Ireland. I thought it would be a small little group, and he had put together this group of people, and my God, I talked about the steps, and I talked about the steps, and I look back now, and I think, oh God, Lila, you were lecturing, you were doing whatever, but I was sharing. I was so excited. And then we taped all of that, and it became a step practice. And I've been practicing those steps with a group of people for all of these years. And every year I look at these steps in a new way. And I found that I reflect in one and two. They're steps of reflection. You know, I just reflect and I realize, yes, I am an alcoholic. And every time I say my name is Lila and I'm an alcoholic, I reaffirm that. And yes, I don't have to understand sometimes when my life is unmanageable. You know, life creates unmanageable situations for us, doesn't it, David? And yet, do we survive them? Of course we do. So I reflect and I think, how do I feel about that? Am I okay? And if I'm not okay, I know that I can go to step two. And I reflect on that because I know that I have come to believe 1,000 times that I will be restored, and I'll just be restored to something as simple as balance. So then two, I reflect every morning. I reflect on them, you know, like, oh, am I okay now? You know, am I okay today? I like to know before I wake up, before I open my eyes in the morning. And then I make the decision, you know. And you know, when we've got, I have broken the steps into, like, I reflect and I think, ah, we're good. And then there's a problem, you know, like 4 and 8 are the only steps really that have anything to do with figuring out what the hell's in the way with for me. Because I believe the steps make room. They make room, they make room, they make room inside of you so that you can go inside and become yourself, so that within you is all you're ever going to need and to receive yourself. Oh, my God, in heaven above, it's unbelievable. You receive bits and pieces of everybody, and then one day you realize, oh, my God, they become me. And so 4 and 8, you know, and then I thought, well, those are the problem steps. There are no problem steps. So why is it that I have spent half of my sobriety worrying about the problem, the problem, the problem? problem. When in fact, I should be worrying about the solution, the solution, the solution. And then I realized, well, you know, 4 and 8 are the only steps that really ask you anything about the problem. And then I looked and I thought, look at that now. 3 may help you make a decision to get the hell out of the way. And 5 is a solution because you're going to talk to somebody to get some help. And 6, you're going to accept all the stuff and they're going to tell you, look, you're responsible for certain stuff and you're going to have to cooperate. So there you go. And then 9, they're going to give you in the first paragraph of the 12 and 12, the qualities that you must meet in order to make these amends that you need to make. There it is. I thought, oh, look at that. 3, 5, 6, 9. And 10, stay current. Well, you know, those are the solutions. And I thought, more emphasis on the solution. And then the magic started to happen to me. Because I thought, wow, if there's something to reflect, I'm an alcoholic, how am I doing today? Better get some balance. What are the problems? What do I have to do about the solution? Then I realized, oh, so it's the outside, and then I've got to emotionally balance myself. What about the inside, Lila? And then I saw, and I only see now, and I will only talk about for the rest of my life, the promises of the steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you read this book and you read those steps, you will reflect, you will see the problem, you will see the solution, and you will see the promises. And the promises are in 7, where you go and you ask for help with everything that you cannot do yourself, anything that you cannot do, because in 6, I am responsible to do what I can do, to accept what I have to accept and to take responsibility for that action and to do something about it. But when I have done all that I can do and I have been rendered powerless so many times, I will go to 7 and I will say, I have done all that I can do. Will you help me? Will you please help me? And the minute I do that, I know then that I am going to go to 11 and I am going to have a conscious contact with the God of my very own understanding. And I am going to get that power to be helped. And I am going to 12 and I am going to say, thank you. I will be grateful. If you're grateful, you can't drink. And I will go out that door. And so I break the steps into that for me. And every now and then I now realize the decision is not to get out. You know, the decision for me is to make sure I don't do it by myself. Oh my God, I don't want to do it by myself anymore. You know, so it's so simple. If I wake up in the morning and I'm off, I don't even have to know why I'm off. I will go to 2 and I will say, ah, you're going to have to restore me. And I will make the decision to have a God of my own understanding accompany me through this rest of the journey through those steps. And I will look, and I look at every year in 4, and I make sure that I'm current with myself or before that if necessary. And I talk to somebody that I trust, and I'm very careful about who I talk to. And I listen to them, and we share experience. I do not give, nor do I want advice. I will ask for it if I need it, and I will only give it to you if you specifically ask me for it. I think that the question of life is more important than the answer. I think that the people who have the answers are terrifying, frankly. So in 6, I then go to 6 and I accept my accept what's going on. I said, listen, if you can't accept it, you're going to have all this upset. And I accept what's going on. I take full responsibility. I take full responsibility. Now, listen, I've taken a bunch of responsibility in step 8. Then 7, I ask God to help me for what I can't do. And in 8, I say, is there anybody that's like in the way? Now, there's times when there's people in the way because we differ in opinion. We're different. There's actually people that I've had to pray for because they were wrong and I was right. But of course, that didn't mean a bloody thing now, did it, to my serenity? And I'm not a person that can forgive. I don't forgive. I mean, that's for you to do when you die. Go forgive yourself. I can only accept things that happen to me. And I will accept them and move on. I will not forgive my father for the horrific damage that he has done to my family and to my deceased mother. That is not my business. But I accept that it happened. It does not bother me. I fully understand it. And I forgive myself for whatever behavior and reactions I needed to protect myself with until I got healthy enough to stop that. So I have begun a lot to experience talking about my concept of my God and my understanding. Just like in the 90s when I went out there talking about those steps and talking about them and talking about them and talking talking about them until finally just like, okay, if somebody wants to know or you're asked to talk, you know, we'll just cover it. Well, one of the things that started to grow in me was that I realized, why aren't you talking about the concept of your own God, of your own understanding? I have no interest in what your concept of God is. I really don't. I just hope you have something. I hope you have something, but I will no longer not speak about what mine is. Because I have found so many people that need the comfort of that. Just like I found so many people that needed to talk about the steps, and now they're all talking about the steps. Hooray! One less thing for me to do. And in page 29, it says, each individual in their personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he establishes relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear idea of what's actually happened. I read that because recently I've had a misunderstanding in my own mind. I believe I am the kind of person that does not have a God of most people's understanding. I don't have an entity. I don't have a Jesus Christ. I don't have any of that at all. I'm positive there's some spirit of the universe that's like got something going on that connects all the dots. I'm positive of that because since I've been in Ireland, I'm looking out at the trees and I'm in the forest and little animals and the beautiful red reindeer here that I can look at across the field and the elk. I understand nature. Nature takes care of itself. It happens. There's a flow. There's a gentleness. Everything the trees talk to one another, they sist. Everything means something. It all makes sense. When there's a completely different view, point of view, when there's no leaves on the trees, for instance, and then when the trees get all filled in, oh my God, you know, then it's different. I can see the lakes when there's no trees or leaves, but then it becomes lush. And we live between a place called the Blue Pool Reserve and right across the street from the Muckross Abbey and the National Park. And here we are, you know, I'm sorry, Jane, did you say something? Muckross Abbey, yeah, anyway. That's a trip in itself. I got lost my train of thought. Oh. Okay. What was I saying? Can you help me with that? Do you have any idea? I was on such a big roll here. Okay, hold on a second. The trees, the forest, how it all makes sense, how nature is in us. And then I became in tune with all these things I'd never noticed before. I'm back. Okay, so spiritually, I realized, oh my God, you've spent time getting sober. You're physically sober. You understand how to put your life in order. You have a very orderly life. You've taken care of all these things that they've told you to do. You've emotionally gotten yourself in balance. You've been using the steps for that. And yes, most of the time, you know, you got this spiritual thing going on, but oh my gosh. And I've been talking about this for a couple of years. What about the rest of it? What about it? I don't, you know, Catholics, I don't know if, you know, you talk about the dead and everything. Great. I'm going to talk about the dead. This is something you can talk about with your sponsor. Enjoy it. That's why I am who I am. I'm going to give you some other things to think about. I'm the best sponsee person in town because I'll give you stuff that you'll say, how could she possibly say that with all those years of sobriety? Now she's going to talk about the fact that, well, you know, Catholics have heaven. Yes. So where are you going? You must be going somewhere. Oh, I don't believe in anything. I just, you know, to dust you are. But that could happen to me. And I'm not going to know because I'll be dust. But you know what? As long as I'm on this planet, that's just not enough for me. I loved and needed the love of my Nana and my granny and my mother and all of them and my brother and my sister. And I need it more now. So what is my concept of God? I part the veil. I part the mist. And there they are. There they are. And I talk to my sister all the time. And I talk to all these dead people all the time. And I enjoy it. You know, I enjoy it. And I remember the moments. I remember when my sister died and I went down to my mother. She had made a little sandwich for herself and she was standing there, you know, as these Irish women do in the kitchen. And she had made another little plate with another little sandwich. And I thought, she must be having somebody over. I said, well, who's that for? And she said, oh, you know, I'm so used to making one for myself. I just made one for Cynthia. Now, I have been reflecting on all of these things. I have been reflecting on how much I need the comfort and the peace to know that I'm going to be going somewhere, to know that there's somebody that loves me, to know I don't trust a God I don't see. I don't trust a church and an institution. That's who I am. I don't have enough faith. I don't have enough trust. I've just started to trust a few people to be consistent in my life. I have just begun to trust and be within myself that I am here. I have purpose. I'm not sure what it is, but I am here. I don't trust anything outside of myself, but I trust them. I trust my granny. I trust my Nana. And that is my spiritual concept of God. I believe that when I was on that bathroom floor, whoever they are, they heard me and they said, well, we'll arrange this now. And so the signs came and I ended up. I believe that my destiny is determined and that if I stay in today, now there's another thing that's going to be sponsored conversation. I come from the old school. I come from 51 years ago. They said to you, how you work this program is a day at a time. But do not kid yourself. You can absolutely have to know. You have to know today. You have to know tonight. You have to know this minute that you are an alcoholic. You have an allergy to alcohol. You have a disease of the soul. You have an emotional imbalance as a result of your drinking. You will drink if you do not get emotionally stable, and you will drink again, or you must correct your soul sickness. I am sober. David is sober. We're all sober long enough to know what that soul sickness is. I have to treat it. Not everybody deals with it. That's fine. Great. No problem. They have something to say too, but I'm not that person. I'm a person that has a soul sickness. I'm a person that if I don't take care of my spiritual self first, I am not balanced. I'm a person that has spent years spending time trying to figure out how am I going to get these steps to make room, to make room, to make room, to make room inside of me, to make room inside of me so that I could bring in all that I believe in, so that I know that when I go where I'm going, I'm going to have, I don't want to wait till I die to have all that I can have. I don't want to wait till I get there. I want to live now. I want to be part of those trees. If Hootie says the trees talk to one another, Christ, I'm out there in the blue pool walking around the place thinking, okay, you're talking to one another. Maybe we can talk about it. And I'm negotiating and I'm out there talking to trees. I mean, I am going to do anything anybody suggests that's going to give me peace of mind. I get peace of mind by knowing that tonight my sister and my brother, who did not make it, are here. I know that they're over my shoulder. I know that when my mother said, Lila, they're never going to understand you, but I will always be there for you. I know she is. I know they still don't understand me. And yes, she's here. I know that my Nana and my granny and my uncles, oh my God, they're so proud of this little immigrant that left Ireland and that came home. They're so proud of me. I'm so happy to be back. I'm so happy to walk on that path again. This is how I live. This is my God. That is my understanding. When I die, maybe there'll be some big God in the sky. Great, I'll say hello. I will still only trust my family. When my mother died, you know, she was a very devout Roman Catholic. Oh, God, how many times we got sprinkled with holy water on the way out the door. And when she was dying, we had on the TV the Vatican Mass, you know, the whole big thing. We sat there and listened to it. None of us, you know, were very much into the church at that time. And my mother, you know, had her rosary beads and a little prayer book, you know, all worn under her pillow. And she was a devout Catholic, and we so respected that. And in came the nun and the priest and the communion, and they would be regularly coming. And this is what my mother wanted, and that is what we gave my mother. And I thought, this is my mother, you know. When my brother died, I had asked her, how did you, she said, I saw your brother, you know, in a dream. And I said, well, that's amazing. And she said, yes. She said, it was like in Phoenix Park. She said, a park like that. And I walked toward these big, huge golden gates. And that's when I knew my mother had a vision of her God and her heaven and her Catholicism, and that she would be all right. And I said, she said, and my mother came toward me. And then she said, and Aidan came. And anyway, the long story short, she said that she would, my mother's, my granny, my nana, said that she would take my mother or my mother the rest of the way through those golden gates. And then I knew that my mother, she said, oh, what do you think it's going to be like, Lila? I said, there's going to be golden gates. I know what you see, you will be given the peace. Now, and I knew that about my mother, and I respected her Catholicism, and I respect everybody's way. But my mother, the night before she died, sat straight up in her bed, and she put her arms out, and she looked to the corner of the room, and she said, Mammy, and she called her mother. And then I knew that that's what would happen for me, that they will come for me like they came for my mother, and that I need them now. I don't have to wait till I die for them to come. I have invited them into our home. I live with a woman of Irish heritage herself. And Jane and I, we understand that, and we laugh about it, and we have a house of dead people, and nanas leave prints on our bed. And this is my life, and this is who I am, and that is what I believe. And I believe that they're there for me, and I believe at the big meeting in the sky, and I believe that they come to hear me, and I believe that Jules is here tonight, and he's saying, ah, yes, you know, you're still the best coffee maker. You're still the best coffee maker, Lila. Give what you can give. Give it freely. Give it honestly. Give it authentically. Give it truthfully. Be who you are, for God's sake. Why else are you sober but to be who you are? I am within myself for the first time in my 73 years and my 51 years of sobriety. If you can honor that, you can be in my life. If you cannot, I will respect and honor your decision. But trust me, I am limiting the people that I need and that I love. I am so regretful that I'm not going to be in the meeting with the people that were there last year that I have looked at every year for three decades or so, David, because I don't know the last names. I don't know what happened, but I know this. We would look at each other and we would hug each other and we would say, yes, it's been another year. I remember when Roy had his heart attack and this guy, and then one day they're not there, and Carol Morgan and Carol Morgan, and then there's no Carol Morgan. And then Morgan has cancer and she can't come anymore. And I think, oh my God, you know, And I feel it because I know everybody. I feel everybody. I don't even know your names, and I know who you are. And on the way out the door, you know, when we leave that room that we had at the Drug and Alcohol Center, and I think, oh my gosh, the newcomers that come in, you know, and they hear this madness that comes out of me. And I think to myself, oh my God, what about them? But I know that they walk out that door and they look at me, and I know they know that they've been swimming with the people that know how to survive, that they've been in a meeting with people that come year after year after year after year, because that's what we share. We don't share the outside, we share the inside. We share the hugs, we share the knowing that we're all right, that we made it one more year. And God, has this not been a difficult year for everybody in so many ways? Oh, the nonsense in AA, you know, this is crosstalk. And any support you can give anybody at any time about anything that they need to say is not crosstalk. It is support. It was Bill Wilson himself that said to a woman, she said, oh, but you know, I have had this problem with medication and I'm sober and blah, blah, blah. He himself said, her name was Dot. He said, Dot, you talk about anything that interferes with your ability to stay sober in these meetings. That's who I am. The spirit of AA is why I stayed. I stayed longer than 3 weeks because I felt something. Do you think I heard anything? Do you think I heard anybody tell me what to do or how to do it really? No, I felt something. I felt safe for the first time in my life. I felt something. I knew that there was something here that was different. And then I felt more safe and more safe and more safe. And now I have taken the journey that the steps will give you, that this program will give you. If you find most of your time in the solution and you find the spiritual promises and you open up that inside of yourself and say, there's got to be something. Perhaps she might be right. Is there really something? Can I be within myself? Yes, you can. Yes, you can. And not everybody needs to be there, but there are some of us, there is one person out there who, like me, is a curious little person who needs to know there's more, and there is so much more. It's in the promises, it's in the spiritual steps, it's in your quest. Oh my God, it's in the trees, it's in nature, it's in going to the meetings, it's in holding each other's hands. It's not, you know, the newcomer. Oh, here we go again. Number three for your sponsor. I don't necessarily think that the newcomer is the most important person in the room. I think they're important. Christ without them would be kind of burned out eventually. We'd all die, wouldn't we? But there'll always be alcoholics. We've been around before Roman times, you think? But you know what? To me, the most important person in the room is the alcoholic who still suffers. And that could be somebody sitting beside you that's been sober a long time. That could be somebody that's aging, that doesn't know how they're going to get to the next meeting. That could be someone whose heart was just broken. That could be someone in the desert years who are wondering, can I stay? Is this enough? Is there any more? Can I get more? I think that every member of Alcoholics Anonymous is equally important. I don't believe that the first guy up in the morning is the most sober person that day. I think that people that have stood here year after year and show up and, like David, come at 9 o'clock in the morning, all these times over and over and over and over again, these are the people that you count on. These are the people that you know are the heart and the blood and the soul of Alcoholics Anonymous. These are the people that take the responsibility to keep the doors open. I cannot be bothered with all of the rhetoric that I have had to listen to on this is the way we do it, and we don't have this in Ireland, we do have this. Oh, please. In the spirit of AA, everybody's included. In the spirit of AA, you get to be who you are. In the spirit of AA, you are loved for who you are. In the spirit of AA, you can have any kind of God concept, be gay, straight, purple, pink, Christ. You can even be a bloody Republican in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm not sure that, about that myself. But either way, you can say what you want. You can be who you want. I'll tell you why. I have no issue with Republicans and Catholics and this and that and all the rest of it. I don't care whether you believe in the dead or you're just going to turn to dust and ash. It doesn't matter to me. What matters to me is that if we show up in these rooms together long enough, we will come to a common ground. And the common ground is that we both need to smile at each other and know that we made it one more year. One more year, one more day, one more phone call, one more meeting, one more moment. And that's what I have inside of me. That's what I want to give you. I just want to give you one more moment. I want to invite you into our Irish home. I want you to sit by the fire and say, be safe. There's no reason not to be safe. And it too will pass, whatever's going on in your life. We have not always had the privilege and the stuff that we've had. I have had great, great hardship and sorrow and disappointment and sadness. But I can tell you that my life is in order, and I make it in order, and I am happy. I would be happy with Jane in a cupboard. I live a simple life. I like the simplicity of not being complicated. I love sitting in an AA meeting. Do you know what it's like for me in Ireland? It's fantastic. I'm considered her Tagalog. I have watching AA. Can you imagine? Bring your little Tagalog with me, he says to me. We're having a new meeting of the Bring Your Tagalog. I thought, oh my God, I'm a Tagalog. Isn't that exciting? You know, it's very, very cool for me. And here, I'm not in charge of anything here. They're Mary and Jane and their Zoom meetings and their coins and their celebrations and their things that are going on. It's on fire. The women in AA here are on fire. And this countess group has turned into like all these little countries. And it's like, oh my God, I am so proud of the people and the women of Ireland. I'm so proud of the man that let me sit at his fire. I consider it sitting at his fireplace, as we've talked about God. We've talked about the promises. We've talked about the spiritual nature of AA. We've talked about more. I cannot be a person of this length of sobriety and not promise you that there is more. Not tell you, please, go back to that book. Read it as the sober person that you are. Find out what you're doing wrong, and then go to that 12 and 12. And for God's sake, practice it. It's of no value until you practice it. And when you practice enough, you will find that you will be within yourself. You will make room. You will have a soul within you, and you will fill it up. And this fear, you will just suddenly one day not have it. You won't want to judge people because it's a burden. You won't have misery because it gets in the way. You'll do everything you can to be in the solution and to be in the promises. And you're never, ever, ever, ever going to feel alone as long as you're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You don't have to explain it all to us. We get it when you call on the phone. We can tell by the sound of your voice how much care and comfort you need. That's who we are. We open up enough of ourselves and we know. We know when to be silent and we know when to speak and we know when to reach out and to hug you and when not to hug you. We have to be more kind to each other now than we have ever been in our lives, especially in Alcoholics Anonymous, especially with this growth that we have had in over 193 countries and a few million strong. As all the people who don't want any change, oh, you can't do this and you can't do that and you can't do that. Oh, fine. You know what? Time will change all of that too. Patient improvement is even occurring in Alcoholics Anonymous. Do you think that even 30 years ago, people like me would be able to have a talk like this? No. I don't know what I've said. I don't know if it's cohesive and I don't know if it makes any sense. I can just tell you, you stay and you sit in that seat and you make it your own and you do everything at the beginning, not for the newcomers. Here's the bad news. Get over yourself. Stop talking. Start listening. Find a sponsor. Do whatever the hell they tell you to do. Not because they're right. Half the time, they're not. Because you need to know how to do things and how to make a phone call when you so don't want to make it. We will teach you at the beginning how to show up and how to come and how to stay. That's what our job is. You listen to David this morning. You'll be listening to wonderful people this afternoon. What time is it?
7:20.
Philo, I think there's people that would like to ask some questions. If you could open it up to Q&A, I would appreciate that.
Okay, it's now open for Q&A. If you would, let's give Lila a big round of applause first off. Lila.